The new movie Dirty Pretty Things is about the underground culture of immigrants who live illegally in London. People who have no papers and can't legally work, so they work in sweatshops, the sex trade, or any place where they can go undetected. The film is directed by Stephen Frears. My guest is the film's star, Chiwetel Ejiofor. He plays Okwe, a Nigerian doctor who, for mysterious reasons, has been forced to live illegally in London. He makes a living driving a taxi and working as a hotel clerk. He's homeless and sleeps on the couch at the home of one of the hotel chambermaids, who is also an illegal immigrant. She's played by Audrey Tautou, who starred in Amelie. The hotel is intentionally staffed by illegal immigrants so they can be underpaid and prevented from reporting on the illegal operations within the hotel. In this scene, Okwe has responded to a report of trouble in one of the hotel rooms, where he finds a toilet clogged by a human heart. He reports it to the manager.
Okwe, everything is all right?
What's this, lunch?
It was blocking the lavatory in room 510. It is a heart. A human heart.
What?
Perhaps you should telephone the police.
Police? You think I should call the police?
Señor Juan, someone is dead.
Okay. You speak to them. You found it. You do the talking. I will introduce you. What's your full name, Okwe? And you never told me where you're from. Or even, how come you're here in this beautiful country? Hello? Police? Yeah, got somebody wants to talk to you.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
We later learn that the heart that was in the toilet is part of the black market trade in illegal organs. I asked Ejiofor if he knows if such a trade exists in London.
I mean, there have been cases, sort of not that have been brought to light, that have been quite as sort of seedy as this kind of backdoor hotel room, but even sort of more high-profiled doctors and whatever, you know, having secret negotiations about taking out and donating organs and people paying people to, you know, to donate organs. And I think it's just the nature of exploitation, that exploitation will inevitably lead to the greatest exploitation, which is exploitation of actual self, physical self, you know, because people have nothing, own nothing, and therefore can sort of do nothing against the system.
Now, your character plays somebody who has come to England illegally from Nigeria, and he's an illegal immigrant there. Your parents came to England from Nigeria.
Mm.
They were not illegal immigrants.
No.
What brought them to England? Why did they leave?
The Civil War. There was the Biafran Civil War, which was, I mean, variously a horrific incident. And they left, and also they were going to study and continue studies as well in Europe, and so they left.
How old were they when they left?
I think they were sort of, you know, early 20s.
So mid-20s. Your father was a doctor, your mother a pharmacist. Had they been practicing yet, or they were still in the middle of their studies?
I think there's some sort of, I think there's conversion courses and stuff that people have to do, but I think they got to a point whereby they were almost ready to start practicing, you know.
What were some of the difficulties they faced in adapting to a different culture?
Well, I think first of all they had the you know, obviously just financial issues to deal with, and that sort of took time and to start to sort of overcome, especially when sort of studying and so on, and really not, although they had some family sort of further in, I think in the north of England, it wasn't. You know, they still had to sort of really fend for themselves, and they weren't really around anybody. So I think that was the sort of initial problem. And then I think the second problem, and a major problem, I think, and a problem that never sort of went away, was the attitudes of the indigenous sort of population, the attitudes of the people around them to them, which I think for the first sort of generation of somebody immigrating to a country who has absolutely no understanding of any kind of racial situation. It's never been something that they'd ever come across or had to deal with or really ever spoken about. And so for to sort of come across these things all of a sudden, out of the blue, I think is an incredibly sort of devastating experience, I think. And I think some people never recover from it in some ways and will never be and will never again be the person that they were when sort of in their teens and so on, these bright sort of effusive lights and this sort of, you know, it's a feeling, I think, of being variously kind of crushed because, being judged on something outside your personality and person is, I think, is an extraordinary thing to face, especially if you've never, you know, heard or come across it before. So I think that was a major challenge to my parents.
How did you start getting interested in acting?
I was, I was around sort of 13 and I found, you know, I was just going through sort of the literature at school and we were reading lots of plays and a lot of Shakespeare plays. I think Shakespeare was the first playwright that we were sort of really seriously kind of trying to study at school. And I remember being sort of, you know, half interested and, you know, slightly distracted and so on. And we were looking through Henry IV, Part One. And, you know, there was just a fascinating monologue, you know, just talking about people who are, you know, young prince sort of talking about, you know, how patiently he will try to come to eminence. And you know, like, I think it's a term like on bright metal, on sullen ground, you know, that actually there's so much within him that he wants to sort of express, but feels that he can't, or feels that he doesn't want to yet, or feels sort of that his time will come. And I remember thinking when I was, you know, just at school and sort of getting through school that that these were kind of the thoughts that I think any teenager and every teenager kind of has. And I just thought it was put beautifully, you know, and brilliantly. And so I started just gaining great interest in the work. I mean, for a while, of course, I thought I'd discovered Shakespeare. You know, I was running through the streets telling everybody, you know, that I discovered this great playwright. And, you know, it turned out to be William Shakespeare. And so, and then, you know, I began to think that it'd be interesting to see these plays, you know, not only to read them, but, of course, you know, what they'd be like to see on stage. And then eventually, you know, what would they be like to sort of do? And you know, it just so happened that the school was doing some plays and Measure for Measure, I think, and you know, I went in to play Angelo, and that's sort of how I started acting.
Well, let me read a review that you got from a performance of Romeo and Juliet in which you played Romeo. This was in the year 2000, and this is a review that was in the Financial Times of London. Tell me, was this in the West End?
It was at the National Theatre on the Olivier stage.
Okay, so here's what the review said about you. Egeofor's Romeo is attractive, impulsive, roguish, and petulant. He also has that rare ability to speak the lines as if they had just occurred to him. When you were preparing Romeo and going over the text and learning it, is there a line that you can use as an example or a passage of how you kind of broke it down and made it both comprehensible and conversational in your mind? A way that you broke it down so that you could deliver it in a convincing and conversational way?
I suppose it's the nature of Shakespeare. I mean, what I'll do, I'll take another play, actually, and do that with it. I think there's another sequence, which is probably better. In the Shakespeare play, Macbeth, Macbeth arrives back at the castle having won the battle for the king, for King Duncan. And the king sort of embraces him and says, it's great to see, and, you know, thank you so much for sort of doing this incredible thing for the country. And Macbeth, sort of not used to public speaking, is sort of expected to kind of, you know, sort of politely acknowledge the king and then sort of, you know, disappear. And there's a passage which I remember as being sort of kind of easy to overlook, actually, in the piece. But once sort of going back over it and sort of repicking it, you sort of see that it actually is one of the most important speeches in the play. And I think he simply says, you know, Duncan says, you know, thank you so much for doing all this. And Macbeth says, the service and the loyalty I owe in doing it pays itself. Your Highness's part is to receive our duties, and our duties are to your throne and state, to your children and servants who do but what they should by doing everything safe towards your love and honour. And it's a kind of moment where Macbeth has suddenly turned around and is telling and informing the king of what his duties are. And it's the first sort of inkling that this play and this person is going to travel a certain line and cross a certain line. And also it's a piece just of somebody getting used to speaking in a kind of public format. And I think that's the thing about Shakespeare, that nothing is wasted. And actually, once you break it down, some of the uses of terms, just as in that line, by doing everything safe towards your love and honour, is, I mean, of course, it sounds very modern. It sounds almost colloquial, you know. And I think that's the thing about Shakespeare, that finding out that about him and finding out how to play that can make it incredibly sort of relevant and interesting and intriguing for audiences.
Romeo is usually cast as a white actor. Was there any problem for you getting the part as a black actor?
No, not really. I mean, you know, the director was Tim Supple, and Trevor Nunn ran the theatre at the time, ran the National Theatre, and you know, I read the part, I did an audition, which they both saw, which they both enjoyed, and asked me to play it.
Another role that you had, which would usually be played by a white actor, is the son in the Noel Coward play Vortex.
Yeah.
And in an interview in The Observer in England, you said, "For me, the only way Noel Coward will survive is by making sure his plays are not just the domain of certain people, of a certain type of actor, because that's the surest way to kill his work off forever." I thought that was really well put. But did you have trouble getting the part? Did you have trouble convincing, you know, the director of that?
No, I mean, again, I think a lot of the times these decisions, and say the complications perhaps of these decisions, are decided, you know, outside the actor's kind of domain. You know, when Michael Grandage came to me with the part, I'm sure he'd already had all these conversations about it. So by the time he asked me if I wanted to be involved, that I think that had already been done. To what extent, and we never really discussed it, to what extent that had been a problem, I don't know. I mean, I certainly know that some of the press, you know, they sort of had various kind of issues with it, I think, but...
Well, in this instance, you know, the mother's white and the son, played by you, is black, so yeah. It's like, well, that, you know, that might seem improbable because it's a white couple having a black son.
Sure, sure. No, so, I mean, that is the nature of colorblind casting.
Yeah, right. Is that an issue or is that not an issue?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's an issue if you make it one, but it's not really. Okay, so there are two white, you know, and they have a black child, and, you know, or there's just three actors on stage, and one is the mother, that's the father, and that's the son. Fine, let's get on with it, you know. You know, I mean, these plays, you know, Nicky Lancaster as an example, and, you know, is nothing but words on a page and an interpretation, and that's it, you know. He's a character in a play written, you know, 1924. I mean, unless you're going to get somebody from that time at the age of, I don't know, 80-something to come in and play the part because he would be authentic or whatever, you know, I don't know how you're going to get something that people could say is the absolute, you know, genuine. Of course, it's an interpretation.
My guest is Chiwetel Ejiofor, the star of the new film Dirty Pretty Things. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chiwetel Ejiofor, the star of the new movie Dirty Pretty Things. Now, if you don't mind my asking, you have a couple of scars on your forehead, which are also visible in the movie Dirty Pretty Things.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get them?
I was in a car accident.
Was this the car accident your father was killed in?
Yeah.
Oh. Was your father driving?
No.
Do you drive?
No.
Is it because of the accident?
Yeah, which doesn't really make any sense because it means other people drive.
Right, it was another person who was driving. Right, good point. but sense doesn't really have a lot to do with fears and phobias.
No. Sure.
You must have had a period of emotional and physical recovery you had to go through after the car accident. Did that kind of set you apart from other people? You know, being sick or being in a life-changing accident like that distances you from other children when you're 11. And that distancing I don't know, it often drives people kind of to become more introspective.
Yes, no, I mean, I think, you know, I think being part of an accident, a terrible accident, is going to make you a little more introspective, yeah. You know, I mean, I think that's just the nature of it. You'll have to consider, you have to consider various things, such as, you know, I guess, you know, what happened and why. And I guess when you start asking those questions, you start asking, you know, from a very early age, very serious questions about your life.
Did that lead you toward religion or toward just more introspection?
In many ways, I think it probably just led me towards the stage.
What's the connection?
Well, I think a stage is, you know, a place where people can express, and writing is a place where people can express feelings and emotions and frustrations and sometimes angers that are just simply inappropriate in everyday life, you know. But a place and a ways, you know, the writing of it, the performing of it, are ways of expressing self, and even the lighting of it, I mean, and the sound engineering of it are ways of expressing self, and art is a way of expressing self, and a way of, and you know, and can be very cathartic, I think.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
No, it's an absolute pleasure.
Chiwetel Ejiofor stars in the new film Dirty Pretty Things. I'm Terry Gross.